Our high school guidance counselor used to ask us what you would do if you had $1 million, didn't have to work. And then invariably, whatever you'd say, that was supposed to be your career. So if you wanted to fix old cars, then you're supposed to be an auto mechanic.
So what did you say?
I never had an answer. I guess that's why I'm working at Inatech.
No, you're working at Inatech because that question is bull to begin with. If everyone listened to her, there'd be no janitors because no one would clean up if they had $1 million.
If I had $1 million. If I had $1 million.
Talking about millions of dollars.
What would you do if you had $1 million?
I'll tell you what I'd do, man. Two chicks at the same time, man.
We're living in a material world and I am a material girl. Or boy.
Well, what about you now? What would you do?
Besides two chicks at the same time?
Well, yeah.
Nothing.
Nothing, huh?
I would relax. I would sit on my ass all day. I would do nothing.
Well, you don't need $1 million to do nothing, man. Take a look at my cousin. He's broke, don't do
If I had $1 million, if I had $1 million, well, I'd buy.
Well, I'm up at Stacks and Jacks. I'm Tamale Andrew on the board. SP Futures up 34, and NASDAQ Futures up 120. Looks like we're bouncing back from two down days. Because we're going to have talks. We bought some futures, and we went out and said we're going to have talks. I mean, that's what we do now. That's the thing. So now we're gonna have talks. So maybe at the end of 6 months, your taxes will go down. Maybe. Everybody seems real happy that they're up, though, I guess. We love it. Thank you, sir. We have Professor Kevin.
Yeah, you do. How Why you is about? That a problem, having talks?
Nothing.
Well, you don't seem really, you don't seem to sound like, you don't sound like it's a good thing.
I'm sure the right people knew about it before the announcement, and I'm sure somebody traded on it. Just saying.
Okay.
We're having talks, two down days in the market, we're going to have talks. When are they? Who are you talking to? What are you doing? What's the agenda? What are we... Just
okay. I know it's kind of the standard accusation, so and maybe it's true.
Let's just say that the norm is that the market is being buffeted around by individual announcements out of people at Washington, and that I would never trusted it under anybody's administration, let alone these guys. I mean, sometimes there was a war on, but even then, you wondered if it was going back to Bush 1, when all of a sudden the whole world started buying puts in the OEX pit, nobody could figure out what happened, and 2 hours later, George 1 came out and said the surprise invasion caught everybody by surprise, Iraq into Kuwait, where the hell it was. George, you might have been surprised, but maybe Morgan Stanley's satellite, they had it figured out. Just when you see people making money on this kind of stuff, Kevin, it sort of gets old. when you elect people to go do something other than that, and that's what they do, it's old. Just what can I tell you?
I understand your concern, but I think it's a good thing that we're having talks.
I think it is too.
I hope it accomplishes something.
I do too. Maybe people's taxes on something bought in China goes from 100% down to 50%. Just saying. I hope that happens. Because who knows? I might have to buy an auto part. I don't want to pay 100%. So there. You can drive old cars and trucks, you end up sometimes buying parts, right?
Okay.
Just saying. I sent you a thing last night, and I honestly don't know. I have any idea. Maybe you don't either. I might be jumping you here. We had the article about, and I'm not accusing anybody of anything here, but the who's this Consumer Protection Board? I thought those guys were all fired. Anyway. I see these things all the time, Kevin, but I've never used one. I don't know anybody who ever has. If you go to buy like a shirt or something at L.L. Bean, they have the L.L. Bean credit card, which I think we all know how to use, plus you use anybody's credit card. Then there's this thing where, pay it off in 4 installments or something. And I guess that stuff's growing. I don't know anything about it. And now I read yesterday that something about the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau said Tuesday, it will stop enforcing a Biden-era rule treating buy-now-pay-later firms like credit card lenders. First of all, what are they? I don't know if they're not a credit card.
That was about truth in lending disclosures. And, it sort of depends on the circumstances. So that one's been on again, off again over the years. It was not part of the regs for consumer protection, for whatever the Consumer Protection Bureau or whatever they call it. It wasn't part of the regs, then it was, now again it's not. So my only question is, what are the terms of those arrangements? Because if all they're doing is charging any interest or anything, then I don't care if it's got a truth in lending disclosure. A truth in lending at 0% is almost irrelevant. But if they are charging interest for it, then it should be subject to truth in lending disclosures. That's my opinion on it.
Well, they're getting money from someplace, either from L.L. Bean or from you, or both.
What do you mean?
Well, they got to make some profit, right? So it's either going to be implied interest, or it's from that you get a discount from the company, and you pay them, or something. But you got to, why is anybody going to do this for free?
Well, if they say your shirt costs $48 and you can pay us $12 a month, or you can pay us $48 in cash, then I would say that the interest rate is zero. It's a payment arrangement, but it's not necessarily a loan, and therefore I don't see why you have to do truth in lending disclosures for it.
I don't think they're
$48 up front, or $52 if you pay us over 4 months, or $58. Then it's a loan with interest, and it should be subject to disclosure. So I'd have to see what the payment arrangements are.
The ones I've seen, Kevin, I don't. If it's $12 a month for 4 months, then it's got to be coming from the person selling it. That would seem odd, doesn't it? It would be like competing against our own credit card. But anyway, it might be. You're right.
It could be, or it could just be that their sales are down so much that it's essentially it's a way of putting it on sale without really putting it on sale.
Yeah, what do they used to call those layaway plans?
Yeah, the same kind of thing, except layaway is when you say put it aside for me and then I'll pay into the layaway, and when I pay it in full, then I can walk out with the product. So this is different. You get the product up front, and you owe them over 4 months. Now, I would assume, are subject to the right collection practices. You know, that how you go about collecting if somebody doesn't pay, still has some very strict rules about when you can contact people, how you can contact them, and so on. You can't call people up at 4 a.m. for example. You got to wait until, I forget what time of day it is. But
5:30. Got to wait till 5:30.
Yeah, you got to wait till. Nah, I think it might be 9:00 or something like that. So how often you can harass people and so on. Those are all part of the collection law. But, as far as a lending disclosure, if there's no interest, then I don't know what they accomplished by having a truth in lending disclosure.
Yeah, I don't either. It's just
other than to give the selling company more stuff to do.
Well, it seems like those guys have had workarounds for like forever. I mean, the states have usury laws, and then the Supreme Court said if the credit card bill comes from out of state, they don't count. And pretty interesting how this all always seems to work out in the favor of big people instead of little people, would you say?
Yeah.
Funny how that works.
Often enough.
Yeah, and everybody's convinced that somehow, that your government is working for you. They will if you make them, and I don't think the middle class has any clue. I mean, I was really kind of surprised. I wasn't surprised. The conversation with Hal yesterday regarding Congress and other stuff, and I guess if you... Depends on what you look at, Kevin. And it's, you can look at, I sent that thing around about the Smoot-Hawley tariffs. I don't know if I agree with the conclusion that the tariffs created Hitler. I think he was already well on his way. But I was to look at the detail in there. To me, it's like reading a Tom Clancy book. I mean, we know there wasn't the war, but reading all the detail and how work had started and how the equipment works and all that stuff, I always found fascinating. But I was, when you compare the difference, what I'm talking about here is the Smoot-Hawley tariffs were put in the, was it 1931 or 2 or someplace in there, but essentially Hoover ran on a protectionist thing for farmers, because after World War One and Europe came back, the farmers here had expanded, well, to as best they could, to essentially feed the world during World War One. And of course, Europe came back to do some farming afterward, and people here had the farmers could have been, you could label it a depression, really. It really started in 1920 or 21, all the way through the 20s. So you had a bifurcation in your economy where some people were, you know, lighting cigars out of $100 bills and with the stock market and buying, you know, Duesenbergs and stuff, and the rest of the world wasn't doing so hot. You could maybe make even a slight correlation to today's world, but today's nothing, I don't think, like that. At least I hope not. And so he ran on this tariff sort of thing, we're going to protect you. At the time, I think, what did things say, 20% of the voters were rural, Kevin, and now it's like 6 or something, whatever. I mean, I don't know if the statistics are all that correct in there, but now Hoover gets in office, and Hoover was, by all accounts, a kind of a really bright guy. I mean, he could have been the most intelligent president we've ever had in terms of being an engineer and worldwide business and all that kind of stuff. And so he gets in office, and now Congress picks up essentially the drumbeat on these tariffs. And well, one of the guys was, what, head of the Senate, and the other guy was head of the Ways and Means Committee. I don't know which was which, Smoot and Hawley. God, did they look like a couple of fossil fates dudes, but people didn't look so good in those days. I don't know if it was the cigarettes or what it was, but so Congress fights over this for like a year and a half. Finally, they pass it. Now, in the meantime, there's been the stock market crash. So the world has totally changed since the campaign. So now they're asking Hoover to sign it, and Hoover's like, wait a minute, things don't look the same as when I promised everybody this thing. So what, he hemmed and hawed over the thing for almost as long as he could, and finally signs it, which added, you know, some fuel to already the depression we're heading into. And you know, they were not a good thing. And to the point where Smoot and Hawley both got voted out, like the next, they both were up for election. They both got voted out. So it was, you know, it was the death knell of those two guys. But the interesting part that I see, Kevin, and it, maybe nobody today cares about, I guess that's the term, is the initial fight for a year and a half was in Congress. You just didn't have this guy come in office, Hoover, and say, here's an executive order, I'm raising all the tariffs. And that's what's essentially happening now, and nobody gets the difference. I don't know. Maybe if everybody decides they want an emperor, you know, I guess we got one, or the next guy will be one, or somebody will be one. But nobody cares. I mean, hell, yesterday, well, Congress has decided they don't want to do anything. They don't have to do anything. Hell, they're a governing body. What are you talking about? Yeah, but they don't seem to want to. Is everybody just gone that way, Kevin? Am I just, you know, lurching in the wake of this, thinking that this is still the way people ought to act when they govern here? But
You got people out there in the political world screaming constitutional crisis, and they scream it for the wrong reasons, as far as I'm concerned.
I might be with you on that, by the way.
The reason that we have the real constitutional crisis that we face is how systematically over a long time that Congress has ceded its authority to the executive branch, so that governing by executive order is the norm. And you know, first of all, it's not productive, because it can get undone every time the pendulum swings the other way. So I don't think that's very it's not long-term helpful. I suppose that if you're looking at it through the Trump lens right now, where he's saying, I have a very, very short period of time when I can reshape everything, and it needs to be reshaped. Whether we will or not, we'll see. I'll be very disappointed if this big, beautiful bill doesn't cut at least $1 trillion out of the budget. But even then, half of that's going to be accounting gimmicks. So we'll see. But we have to start taking apart the expenses If we don't, you know, we're in trouble already. But we, you know, it's only going to get worse. So we have, you know, we have all of this stuff to deal with, which is, you know, which I think is important. But you know, I'm sort of veering off topic because the real issue is that Congress should be doing whatever it can to take back its authority, and it's not happening. And
do you think, quick question, what you said earlier, do you think they've ceded their authority by what's, you know, this, you're the professor, what do they say, by admission, or what's the word, did they do it on purpose, or they just don't do
by
anything
omission. By omission,
yeah. I mean, not, it's not like totally. They all got together one day and said, we don't want to do this. They just don't do it.
What they did was, you know, we have the, you know, what we call the filibuster rule, which isn't really the filibuster as it, you know, as it is historically known, and more the requirement to get 60 votes for cloture in the Senate. And so with the inability to get things passed, unless you have over 60 in the Senate and you control the House, if you can't pass it, then you do something by executive order, and Congress has not put a stop to that. They just let it happen over and over again. You know, Carl likes to cite, you know, President Obama signing the DACA or issuing the DACA order and saying he knows he really isn't, you know, he really can't do it. Well, fine, I know you can't either, but he does it. But I think it goes back farther than that. And, you know, I really think that, you know, everything, we need things to be a vote. And, you know, it's not. that's how representative government is supposed to work, and that's not what's happening.
Well, if you have a bill of any kind of magnitude, and you can't get anybody from the other side to say it's a good idea, I don't know about the 60 versus something, but if it's a major tax issue, a major Medicare issue, whatever it is, if you can't get 60 votes, I don't know if the thing should pass. This idea that every single Republican, every single Democrat votes yes or no on every bill, that's the problem.
Yeah, and actually, I think when it comes to that, to keeping the vote in line, I think the Democrats are way better at it than the Republicans. The Republicans always get a few that stray off the reservation. The Democrats are really good at party discipline. For you know, which I don't necessarily, I'm not saying that's a good thing. I'm just saying they're really good at it.
I might push back on that here. It seems to me, Kevin, that whoever the party is in power, you think that all Republicans think alike and all Democrats think alike. They really don't. And as soon as one side gets, say, 55 in the Senate or whatever it is in the House, the little splinter group in that party, they almost become like a third party. Right now it's I don't know if they try to do something. Now right now it's the real conservative wing of the Republican Party. It doesn't think Trump's going far enough. I mean,
you also have the group of people from high property tax states that are really, really pushing hard on what do they call it, the salt cap, which I know you've always said you wanted to see indexed.
I want the capital gains tax index.
Oh, okay. Because the state and local taxes is a different issue, we could argue that separately. Let's not dive into that one now. But the point is that you do have people who are splitting off on that. I forget who the congressman or who the senator was the other day that said, I'm not voting for one of Trump's nominees. So you get some opposition. Rand Paul is often a contrarian, so you have him to deal with. Whereas I think Nancy Pelosi was so ruthless that she could make life miserable for anybody who strayed off the
Obama had splinter groups in his stuff. in the Senate, maybe not in the House, but in the Senate he did. I think in the House it's easier to keep control, because what do you do all day? If you get banned from a committee, what do you do, go play racquetball? I mean,
you fundraise.
Well, okay, but I mean, but you know, it's, I don't, but you know, the thing I have, Kevin, is we talk about it on the show, and I honestly don't hear it any other place. I mean, you can talk about let's go there a little bit, the tax part on the high property tax and so forth states, and we can say, oh man, it's, those are dirty Democrat states, screw those people, blah blah blah, but
it's not. I know you like to say that, but that's not the argument.
Okay, it just so happened to be at the time Connecticut was the state they were bitching at. But my point is, what is, since we have, I mean, how many people even know this? I mean, you do. The U.S. might have, I won't say the only, because I don't know the tax of every country in the world. I'm not about to say that I do. But we are seemingly somewhat unique in the few countries that I've looked at in having this at least three-tiered tax system here. We've got income taxes, we've got payroll taxes, we've got state taxes, and we got local taxes. And the idea that we're the only place that seems to be greedy enough to have taxes on other people's taxes. I mean, I would say that if you make 200 grand a year and your state takes 5% or whatever some states do, well, a lot of states do, at least in Chicago, the municipality doesn't take any, but in some places they do. And oh, by the way, you've got this property tax and what. You're not making 200 grand. I'm sorry. I mean, you're walking in the door with 200. So to have a federal tax on the two, I mean, 150, you're not. I mean, what is our position, our country's position on tax on tax? I mean, in Illinois, absurd.
Country's position on that particular tax is that some states are far more frugal than others, and they make it up by the ones that are that don't control their spending make it up with very high property taxes. And so while, you know, my taxes might be lower than yours depending on our states, I don't think mine is, but I'm just subsidizing. I say if I'm from a low tax state, I'm subsidizing your high taxes. So either make it go all away, or put a cap on it. And you know, this is one of those things where people complain about tax cuts for the rich, when in fact that for people who have more expensive homes and therefore higher taxes was actually a cap, an additional tax on wealthy people that nobody ever wants.
Well,
to
okay, decide. But here's the problem you run into, Kevin, is when Trump did this in 2016 or 17. Okay, when he you know, was doing his thing, when he did that, the number was, what, it was $10,000, right? Well, because of him and Biden after him, everything is 40% more expensive, maybe more, than the day he did that. And the person who was paying $10,000 in a property tax or whatever the one was over a number might have been some small percentage of the population. Now, because of his incredibly lack of governance and Biden's, I'm going to say a boatload of people pay over $10,000 in taxes, even in some of the states that he thinks are good. And that thing, because of inflation, it is now expanded to a point where it's a problem. I mean, when the what's the alternative minimum tax?
Which Tom would be why you would index that cap?
But they don't.
You know, they don't.
The same way they don't index the $3,000 you can deduct on stock,
and
for God's sake.
Because you have a whole bunch of people who are pushing back on that right now, maybe that's what's going to happen.
Maybe, but until then, you're paying. You know, with the alternative minimum tax, Kevin, we went through this. We had an expert on the show one day, not me. The first year that was passed, wasn't it like, was it under 100 people it affected? And now everybody we know has to go through the alternative minimum tax calculation, and it's affecting all kinds of people. This kind of stuff just can't happen. I don't know what you want to call it. It's governance by by something, right? I mean, but it's not. It's just not. But I mean, just in general, I don't think. No, Pritzker's not going to listen to me. I don't think when there's 75 cents or whatever it is tax on gasoline, that I should pay sales tax on the other tax. Now, nobody wants to listen to me, but I don't like tax on top of tax. I mean, now somebody with the cars that go out there and say, Kevin, you got your scratch. You dug out from the backyard with some $100,000 worth of stuff, and you went and bought like a Jeep. You pay $100,000 for a friggin' Jeep. Okay, what's the tax? $10,000. Well, hell. That's a lot. It's not like cars cost, $3,500 and the tax was 7%, where it was 200 hours. It was a pain in the ass, but it wasn't, But how do you pay $10,000 sales tax and not have it be a chunk out of your hide, whoever you are? Oh, by the way, I made $250,000 last year. I mean, I didn't, but... And all of a sudden, I paid 10 for that. Now I'm down to $240, and I'm paying the Fed on the full $250. Well, that's interesting, isn't it? These numbers have gotten so big that you wonder where the logic is or was, in my opinion.
Well, you know what my solution to all that is we should scrap the entire tax code, go to something very similar that's basically just a check-off, very straightforward, not a lot of deductions, if any. And call it a deal. The effect, the rate would be lower, but without all the exemptions, the collected rate would be higher.
I'm going to say, in theory, I'm with you. In practicality, I'm going to say, bullshit. Why do you think it's gotten so complicated? Because people have worked around the simplicity.
Well, people have worked around the simplicity because the real reason it's gotten so complicated is because that's a really, really good way for me to favor whoever it is that I choose to favor. And we cobble them in one at a time. And by the end of the end of period on that cobbled in one at a time gives us a multi-thousand page tax code.
I don't know why it is, but actually in one of the, it was either first, when we first started Stocks and Jacks, when John and I were both on the score, We had an argument on the air regarding this very subject, and I think it ended up on YouTube, and a lot of people listened to it. And John had pretty much the same argument you had, and I think
John's a very smart guy.
Oh, absolutely. By the way, are you moving to Puerto Rico like he is, because you got so much money? No. I think that's somewhat. Somewhat naive, because nothing is simpler than you charge stuff for stuff, you got expenses, you got income, you pay tax on the income. That to me is pretty simple. Okay, but then again, maybe it's not. I mean, I give the example of, now suppose we did that for Stocks and Jacks. Of course, we don't make any money, but if we did, all of a sudden I get some guy, I don't know who, say somebody sponsors us for $1 million a year, Kevin. Well, I don't know who that guy would be. But if somebody did, and I got my expenses of, paying the dudes and paying for the feeds and stuff, so say they're 150. All right, so how simple would it be for me to just pay tax on the 850? I don't think there's anything wrong with that. However, I don't want to do that. Why the hell should I do that? I'm better than that. I'm going to put, we'll drag Thomas out of retirement. I'm going to send Thomas down to Bermuda or some damn place. And I'm going to say that Thomas is going to send me a schedule of who the producers are going to be every morning. And he's going to get two guests for me. And oh, by the way, I'm going to put the Stocks and Jacks trademark, which I have, over in this little group in Bermuda that's now a sub from Stocks and Jacks. And we're gonna send Thomas in this other place, let's say $15,000 a month. So now we don't have any profits here. Yet we're here. Now we're profiting out of Bermuda. So now the tax code is gonna, all of a sudden people are gonna see stuff like this happening. They're gonna try and quote fix it. All of a sudden, the tax code is no longer than one page. Somebody else finds a way to do some depreciation another way. Now it's three pages. That's how it's grown, because people can't just... People like me, I would actually, wouldn't mind sending them a check for the $850 we just made. Nobody else wants to do that. They've got to get around the friggin' thing. And then it becomes more and more and more complicated. And then all of a sudden you get people talking to the people at the IRS. Oh man, this is fair. Why can't I just pay this guy overseas? Why can't I do this? All of a sudden we get this colossus, this mess. And it's all because I think people try to work around the simple stuff. So to say, we just might as well be simple. It got where it is because people cheated on the simple, in my opinion.
Yeah, it depends on what the rate is, though, Tom, because if you set the rate at a proper level, then you're not going to, it's not going to be worth it. The expense of operating differently is going to outweigh the savings.
The way it is
right now, your savings are much, much larger. And as a result, it's worth it to operate that way. But it would not be worth it to operate that way at a tax rate that is comparable to the lowest in the world.
I'm going to very rarely, because obviously I learned so much from your opinion. Very rarely am I going to say bull crap. There are people in this world, you know, maybe you don't find them at Ivy Tech. If the tax rate was 5%. They're going to find a way to pay one because they get an advantage over the other guy. It doesn't matter what the rate is.
Nobody's charging a 1% corporate rate.
Well, I'm saying no matter what it is, there's going to be somebody who's going to cheat on it. You would think, okay, everybody's cheating because it's 50%. Let's make it 30. It's fair enough. There's still people who go, okay, Kevin's paying 30 in his business. If I can find a way to pay 10, guess what? Next time some business for sale, I get to outbid Kevin.
Hey, Tom, if you can find the place that is only charging 10% on corporate tax, go for it.
What are you talking about? Ireland and all those people were paying it. That's where all those places were.
So let's just say we were comparable to that. Would it be worth it to go to the trouble to set up and say and shave off a percent?
No, but what is wrong with people here having to share in the expenses?
Share in the expenses?
Of running the place. You and I don't get to say, hey, we don't want to pay 35 because the rate's 2% in India.
Okay.
So why should a corporation?
Well, we should not be saying because it's 2% in India, because that's distorting the argument, because it's not 2% in India.
What is it? I don't know.
I don't know, but it ain't 2%.
Well, it was 5% and the... What was the place in downtown... you remember this? It was a place in downtown Dublin, down by the docks. What the hell was that? Some kind of a tax-free zone where everybody put up offices over there? Was 5% or something?
So you take product out of it, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I'm saying just because it's fair doesn't mean people don't cheat, because it's a massive advantage. The idea that we let people offshore stuff and then bid for companies here, God, Kevin, it got to the point where if you weren't cheating, you weren't trying. How could you and I, if we were co-heads of some big drug company here, all right? If how could we possibly compete against everybody else? If everybody else goes overseas and we're paying 35 and they're paying 15 or 10 or something, how could we possibly compete if we're bidding for the same stuff and buying the same stuff as they are? You can't let that happen. You can't let cheating. It's like on the trading floor. There only were a couple guys that tried to follow brokers into pits. You can't let everybody do that, because all of a sudden you got 1,000 people running around the floor chasing an order. It's the same thing. If you let enough people cheat, cheating becomes, if you're not doing it, you're not trying. You can't get there. And we're there. I mean, I think we're both agreeing on that.
Well, we are. I'm looking up lowest corporate tax rates in the world, because I think when we should probably be working with a real construct that makes sense. Unfortunately, my response is very slow at the moment.
Well, what was the reason why Starbucks had how many stores they have in London? It was like hundreds and hundreds, wasn't it? Yet their all their profits were in Amsterdam, because they allegedly put the beans from Amsterdam and resold them. What did Bob tell us? Was it the double Dutch sandwich or something? You make it all back on transfer pricing. That's why I was asking Hal yesterday about, you know, the tariffs and how. I don't think this is. You know my opinion on the tariffs is I think Trump has no freaking idea of what he's doing with tariffs. He's had this thing in his mind for 50 years or whatever. But if we really want to level the playing field in terms of child labor and stuff, by the way, I haven't asked your opinion on this, or on pollution and stuff, I guess we could tax our people with tariffs and hope it falls out all right. Why can't we just say, if you don't have child labor laws, we're not going to impair anything from your country? That'd be pretty harsh, but that would be another way to do it instead of just taxing our people. I mean, I don't know that in part of these talks with China, is anything going to have to do with child labor? I don't think so. Is anything going to have to do with pollution over there? I don't think so. Maybe. I hope so. But, I mean, what if we want to stop the things that Carl wants to stop, how do we do it? I mean, tariffs is not any kind of an economic approach that I would use. What can we do? Are we willing to tell our corporations, you can't go somewhere else, hire people that are 12 years old, and sell your crap here? Are we willing to do that? Is Trump willing to do that? I think the answer is no. And I'm not so sure I would if I was in the office either. I mean, imagine the pressure you get from all sides. I'm not saying this is easy. But remember the Untouchables? Sean Connery asked Kevin Costner, what are you prepared to do? What are we prepared to do? Right now, we're prepared to tax our own people. I don't know. I don't know. That doesn't get there, in my opinion. But how would you do it? How do you?
So what we're really looking about, unless you want to do business in Bahrain or the Bahamas, where they don't have a corporate tax rate at all, that's their lowest statutory corporate tax rates, and they don't have any they don't include any additional taxes and fees that you have that they collect incidentally. So this is just an income tax rate. So Bahrain and the Bahamas are 0%. Then you go Barbados, Hungary, Emirates at 9, Andorra at 10, Bosnia and Herzegovina, Bulgaria, Republic of Kosovo, and I can't pronounce this, too many consonants. 10%.
Why did you blow over to Bahamas? That's the first firm that left here. The first medical firm was Forest Labs, and they went to the Bahamas and they took all their patents and registered them, and they moved them to some sub in the Bahamas, and they paid transfer taxes to rent their own patents, and that's how they pushed the money into the Bahamas. So don't discount.
I didn't mean to blow over it. I think that's substantial. But it depends on the arrangement, and it depends on what other kinds of fees, operational fees that they charge you, and I don't know what those are.
Oh,
and,
you know what? Let me help you. They charge you.
And the report I got is not. It says those exist, but it's not detailing what they are, and I'm not going to keep.
I'll help you on that. By the way, they're a lot, because I was involved in a hedge fund.
Plus the bribes you got to make.
I was involved in a hedge fund.
Put you in jeopardy of the foreign corrupt practice.
No, this was... You ever heard of a master feeder hedge fund? I managed one of those for a while. It didn't work out so well, but people I was with were a little odd. But a master feeder hedge fund means that you can take overseas money and U.S. money, both with the rules overseas and in the U.S., and merge it into a master fund, and the master fund came out of the Bahamas. And all these different fees were allegedly low because none of these people wanted to pay any taxes. But what you are alleging, by the way, and bite my tongue, you don't know how right you are. This fund had to have a Bahamas attorney. We had to have a Bahamas depository. And I think we had to have a Bahamas auditor. You wouldn't think there were all those people in Bahamas, but there are. And I think our expenses out of the Bahamas for all that crap, even though, you know, there wasn't going to be any taxes, I think it was $3,000-$5,000 a month or something, Kevin. The auditor was like $2,000 a month. I don't know what the hell he did. The attorney that held the trust or held the fund, they were one of the places here, but they had based it in Bahamas. When was the last time I said that you are so right you don't even know it? it's a huge industry down there of that stuff, and they've got all these rules making you use their people. You drive around down there, you don't even know they're there, but they're there. You got to use their people to do all this crap. So yeah, there are fees.
Yeah, and ChatGPT is telling me that while these countries attract businesses with no corporate tax, operating costs can still be high due to fees based on gross revenue, not profit, and high customs duties and consumption taxes. And then it breaks it out in some specific ones where you have a lot of VAT, and you know, for anything that you do. So there are other taxes. So it's not zero.
Oh,
it's
right, you're right. I mean, but the other thing is, I think there's an anonymity that goes with it as well, or at least used to. I don't know that the people who fed into this fund from the foreign side were even known to the people on this end who the hell they were. I mean, it's a multifaceted game. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, it is, and you have to have, you know, you're really good accountants and tax attorneys to navigate it properly. So, you know, at that point, yeah, I do get that you get people who are going to try and get around the system as much as they can, but, you know, to the extent that a country normalizes its way towards that 10%, well, I would imagine if you got rid of all the deductions and different kinds of allowances. Now, I'm not suggesting that we put the tax code onto a cash basis. I you know, the accounting principles probably still have to apply. But it may be that you start crowding down towards that 10%, that if you're collecting everything, if everybody's paying it, because how many companies have a zero or near zero effective tax rate? Because of everything that they can remove from their net income. And the answer to that is, so when we look at those and we say, oh, we're going to charge an extra 5% to those companies, and they look at it and go, oh, no, please don't do that, all the while knowing that 5% added on to what they pay on zero is still going to be zero.
Well, except that when you, I mean, unfortunately, well, I remember some of this, because I used to do people's taxes when I worked for Pullman on weekends. Back when things were, well, in some ways they were simpler, in some ways they aren't. The tax rates were higher, Kevin, yet you could deduct a whole bunch of crap, right? And a lot of it was other taxes. And I think that something like that...
Also things like personal interest. Your car loan was deductible.
Yeah, interest was deductible.
Credit card interest.
Well, now, why is interest deductible for a company and not a person?
That's right. That's what I mean. So, you know, interest is a choice for financing.
Yes and no.
Well, and you know, some companies don't have a choice if you want to grow. So I'd have to think through what the accounting is that goes into net income reporting. But I know that special depletion allowances and things like that I'm probably not going to do.
You don't have an oil well unless you're holding out on me.
I'm thinking of drilling in the backyard.
So. You're going to end up with water.
Yeah, I'm sure as hell will.
But, you know, even that, Kevin, is complex. Now, God, back when I was in grad school, let's look at short-term financing, long-term financing. If you and I had an electrical company, and all of a sudden we went out for bid at, you know, an expansion of McCormick Place or some big building, whatever it is. If the specs were written that they didn't give us any money up front, we had to finance the whole deal, which sometimes they are, which really kind of sucks. But and all of a sudden, you and I have this nice little electrical company, and we have to go out and buy $500,000 worth of crap for this place to put it all in there, and 6 months from now, they're going to pay us, you know, $800,000 or something. And we have to pay interest on that $500,000. I don't think there's anybody that would say that should not be deductible, because it clearly is a cost of that job, right? I mean, we don't need all that stuff except for that place. That's part of this bid. Now, I would say that, in my opinion, should absolutely be deductible. Let me finish up. Now, on the other hand, if you and I have a company that has, you know, $5 million worth of stock in it, and we say, boy, you know, we're getting to be big boys here. We think we need $10 million worth of capital. So we have a choice of either going out and borrowing for, let's say, 20 years, however long we can get, or selling more stock. Well, the idea that the interest is deductible and the dividends aren't is pretty bleeped up in my mind. But now those are two totally separate decisions. One is short-term financing for a job. One is the long-term financing of the company. And the idea, and you know, one of my pet peeves is dividends ought to be deductible. And you shouldn't have to pay twice. If we raised, I think a lot of what's wrong in this country in terms of corporate stuff, you know, and again, I can overshoot this. If we were to raise the corporate rate to the same as other people pay and let dividends be deductible to where the person only has to pay once, I think you would not have companies hoarding this kind of cash where they don't need just because they want the power. I think you'd have a more streamlined, companies would only invest in stuff that they wanted to do, not just because they don't want to pay it out because people have to pay twice. I think we'd be way better off. And by the way, a lot of that company, that cash would come to people who own the stock who deserve it, and I think it would be way better. Yet nobody cares what I think on that. What do you think on that? I mean, there's something I would do tomorrow.
Well, yeah. First of all, it makes sense, Tom, in that isn't issuing new stock another form of taking out a loan?
No, because the dividends are not deductible.
I understand that, but theoretically, all you're doing is saying, "Where am I borrowing the money?
No,
I'm going to borrow from investors, or I'm going to borrow."
No,
I'm going to borrow from a bank.
If you came from the University of Chicago School, long term debt is on your long term financing piece of your balance sheet, and ought to be treated the same as stock in terms of taxes. I think.
Yeah, I would be fine with that. I don't have a problem with that.
Now, short-term is different. And why is there a double taxation on dividends? Because it's an excuse to never pay a dividend, or rarely pay one. I mean, I'd sure like to give those guys... I tell you what, even Warren Buffett...
What was anticipated when it was set up that way, but certainly the way it is.
It's certainly the way... I mean, Warren Buffett would have a hard time.
Because what do we always get out of the tax code? Exactly what the code rewards.
But right now, even a guy like Warren Buffett or Elon Musk would have a much tougher time defending their no dividend policy if they didn't have to pay taxes on it. They'd have a much tougher time. Not that they couldn't defend it, or maybe have the egos to defend it, but it's pretty hard to defend. If right now, what's the definition? We already paid taxes on it. If we send it to you, you got to pay taxes again. And if you let us use it instead of you, we have more to start with, so we'll be more efficient. That's the definition. It was a definition when I was in grad school eons ago. Right?
Okay.
And, you know, these are little things that, you know, you and I, if anybody listened to us, we could tweak, and I think, you know, we wouldn't change the world, but we really would change a lot of how people go about their corporate, their corporate financing in other ways. And the way it's done now is designed, or maybe it wasn't, or maybe it wasn't designed this way, but it ended up this way. You don't want to hit, I mean, Jeff Bezos doesn't want the question about where the hell's my dividend, right? I mean, isn't that why, but I always try to go back to the basics, and I think so do you. You and I are going to invest in Andrew's hot dog stand. It's pretty simple. Andrew was pretty good at making hot dogs. Okay, we're going to give Andrew...
What hot dogs is he serving?
I bet he's... I don't know. He works at Cane's, the chicken joint. I bet they're bite-sized hot dogs. They're finger food, probably.
I would say I'm strictly a chili dog kind of guy.
Well, there you go.
I'm not really a Chicago dog person.
Now, wait a minute.
Good man.
Wait a minute. Who invented the chili dog?
That I got no idea.
Probably Coney Island, but...
Actually, it's the... Isn't the guy on the south side, the guy who's got the shotgun under the thing at the Western and Southwest Highway? Tell us the name of that place. If he's still there. They invented the cheddar cheese, the cheddar chili dog or something.
Chili cheese dogs are good, yes.
Yeah, I think he might have invented that. That place, oh boy, you got to take your life in your hands to go get dogs. No fries, and he's got a shotgun under the counter. A little trailer out in front of his house. Tell us the name of the place. I'm going to brain dead. Anyway, I'm saying, now, how simple can it be? We give Andrew $100,000 and we say, Andrew, pay yourself, you know, $5,000 a month, and at the end of the year, we'll split the profits. How tough can this be, Kevin? And now, oh, wait a minute, I can't give you guys any money. I got to pay taxes twice. Wait a minute. How did this get so complicated? But it did. You're right, somehow. Right? I mean, it started out pretty simple, didn't it?
Would we ever get to the one pager? Probably not.
No.
Could we get to a much simpler tax code? I would say yes.
I think if we were a little less, I'll use the term, somebody who thinks up a way to get around it, if we were a little stricter with them, I think the tax code would be 80% less than it is now. I don't know if we ever get to the one pager.
Yeah, I think, you know, rather than hiring all these accountants and such for the IRS, we just need a few thugs.
Well, in the immortal words of our buddy and probably, you know, maybe your best friend and one of my friends, Bob Golden, I remember asking him one day, I said, Bob, when you're in front of the IRS and you're running this crap by them, how do you keep a straight face? And he says, Howard, 600 hours an hour, you learn how to keep a straight face. I'll never forget that line ever. He goes, we know it's crap. We know these guys are idiots for saying yes, but we did it anyway. Okay, then. I said, Bob, what's your justification for the double Dutch sandwich? He goes, there is none. They just bought it. Okay, then. I miss him. Kevin, I know you do, too.
It's a weird business. And, you know, there's a lot of dynamics that would prevent it. Obviously, there's the people who are interested in perpetuating such a system. But in addition to that, you have a whole industry built around taxes that is going to give ground grudgingly. So,
well, my tax return.
And what is that industry? A whole lot of attorneys. And who is in Congress? A whole lot of attorneys.
Well, my tax return has to be...
We just spent the better part of an hour musing about something that just is never going to happen.
But, you know, I think when we muse about it, though, Kevin, we bring up pieces of things that make some sense that people, you know, some of the listeners might say, you know, that does make sense. Why the hell aren't we doing it that way? I mean, it's not like there aren't other ways to do this stuff. There are, right?
Well, there are other ways, and so, you know, probably this is an old lesson I learned, is that doing something because that's always the way we've done it is probably the worst reason to do something.
Yeah. What did when people were a little bit more rebellious when we were young? The Observer was the name of the newspaper at Notre Dame, and they were, you know, during the Vietnam era, they were a little more shall we say, what's the word, cantankerous than they are today, where you could actually publish stuff in the what was it? University motto? There's no reason for it; it's just our policy. Remember?
That's it. I've used that line a lot.
And how true is that? There's no reason for it; it's just our policy. It is crazy. I just wish that this thing all. I don't understand why. And I'm not saying that somehow trying to bring some of these countries to bear. And I'm not so much against, quote, the policy, Kevin, but I'm aghast that people don't realize the price they're paying to get there. And I've probably talked to 50 people in the last 5 weeks, 45 of which have no idea that a tariff is a tax on them. I mean, how do we get that way? I mean,
enough publicity now that I think a lot more people than that do realize.
I think they're getting there.
But what the common conception is that it's a tax on them because prices will be raised. And yeah, I do think prices will be raised to some extent. But you and I had this discussion over the weekend. Not everybody is doing cost plus. So, you know, as you look at it, you might be able to pass on, and we've seen that during, you know, the most inflationary periods of the last few years, where prices went up. But we also saw pushback on that in terms of lower volume, and then people, who then, resorted to, say, like the fast food industry. Everybody rededicated themselves to having a menu of cheapy meals because nobody was buying, their stuff. They had to do something to get people back into the stores. So, because pricing is about what people are willing to pay for something, not what you can charge, not what you're charging.
Well, except the only thing with that, we'll continue that on Friday, but just kind of last comment, we'll get the Russell. The thing of it is, Kevin, I think that, boy, back in the day, I actually could have done a lot of this on the blackboard when they had blackboards. If you, and Hal's right, you got to look at the elasticity of supply and demand. There's a million words I can throw in there. But the fact is if all of a sudden tomorrow, and I'm not saying this administration or any administration, just said, you know what, we think people that buy new cars like got too much money. I'm not saying anybody would ever do this. We're going to put a $3,000 tax on every new car. Now, you and Hal and everybody else is absolutely correct that nobody knows exactly how much more the new car is going to cost, how much the demand curve is going to drop, the quantity demanded will drop because the price has gone up, how much the supply curve is going to move up because maybe there's less demand, so it might go the other way, and maybe the car companies eat some of it. But this I will absolutely guarantee. The price is going to be higher than it was before, and the government gets the $3,000 check. That I can guarantee you. And there's no way the elasticity comes down to where the car costs less unless there's a friggin' depression. It's just not going to happen.
Except that you do have competitive markets where some companies are going to go and say, I forget which one is advertising now, that they've lowered all their prices and taking a shot at Ford and that employee pricing. They said, we have lowered it on all of our models, not just selected
ones.
But
don't, I'm with you on this. That will happen. That's what all the different curves, all the different theories say. But the fact is, somebody's getting the check for $3,000 and it's coming out of somebody's hide. And I guarantee you, Ford is not, in my example, Ford's not going to drop the price of the car $3,200 to where you're whole. It's not going to happen. No externality, no demand curve, no supply curve will ever get you to that spot unless you're in a depression.
Yeah, so I've already told you who I think the companies that will thrive in this environment will go for market share are. They're the people on the lower end of the cost spectrum anyway, because they've already learned to operate on tight margins, tighter margins.
Except that but there isn't a person on earth that knows exactly where on the scale employee pricing is. They can say whatever it is.
That's Ford. I wasn't talking about Ford. I was actually surprised that Ford made the first move to do anything on pricing, because I really thought it would be Kia or Hyundai or somebody like that.
Well, Ford assembles more cars in this country than anybody else.
I understand that, but we do have lots of lots of manufacturing from the other producers. So.
How much? We got to get to Russell, or maybe if he's on, he can find. On a BMW or Mercedes or something assembled here. And this, I don't know the answer to this. What percentage? And it's probably different for every car. What percentage of the car is actually? I'll use the term producer. When I say assembled, it's like a railroad car. We assembled it, but we bought the trucks, we bought the seats, we bought the lights from everybody else, and we just, built the shell, which is next to nothing, really, in terms of cost, and hung all the rest of the stuff on it. I mean, is the BMW transmission, motor, seats, all that crap coming from Europe? I don't know. I mean, I'm going to say probably yes, but I guess what I'm saying is 75% of the car's cost coming from overseas, or is it 20%?
Yeah, and I don't have the data to tell you the answer to that. I can tell you I'm very aware of some suppliers who actually supply. I know one in particular that I've done some work with that they supply BMW and they manufacture in Goshen, Indiana.
And they
export to export to Germany.
Well, some people. Like the fuel injectors and those kinds of things. Actually, way back when I was a Ute, I saw some guy working on a Rolls Royce, And I see the Delco air conditioner in there. And I said to the guy, how come there's a Delco air conditioner in a Rolls Royce? He goes, because they're the best. Okay, then. I mean, you know, there's parts that people make that use, I mean, spark plugs, I got to believe, are made, everybody uses the same kind of spark plugs, don't they? I would think. I don't know. It's been so long since I worked on a car, Kevin. But I don't think you want me working on your car anymore.
No, you don't want me working. I don't want you working on my car, nor do I want anybody to have to work on my car.
Well, isn't that the truth? All right, take care, bud. We'll talk on Friday. What do you think of the Golden State? Might actually, because of Jimmy Butler, they might actually make it to the finals. For God's sake, that'd be something, a play-in team.
That happened before. Miami did that. wasn't Jimmy Butler on that team too?
Well, somebody came back from injury, I think, on that. People thought it might happen last year with the center on Philadelphia coming back, but he wasn't really healed, was he?
No, he wasn't.
That's a shame.
I'll see you. Hi, Russell. Bye, Russell.
Hey, I got to ask you a quick question. How happy are you two Jamokes that you weren't sitting at the Cub game last night in the top of the 11th when the other guy scored 9 runs?
Yeah, I know. That sucked. They had a chance to finish off the comeback in the 9th, and then they didn't execute in the 10th when they had a runner on third with less than 2 outs. So, and then the 11th happened.
Well, I was lucky. I turned on the basketball game and dozed, so I missed it all. Missed them both. But Russell, how are you, buddy? Kevin, take care.
I'm doing okay. About a third, or about 2/3 of the parts on an average BMW assembled in the United States comes from outside the United States. It depends on the model. It can be as much as 91%. It can be as low as around about 60. But typically about 2/3, depending on the model.
So that would be motor, transmission, diff, and seats. Probably 2/3.
I have no idea what parts. I just know the percent. So you got to assume that's what the if the tariffs end up being a real thing, that's what's going to be charged.
All right. Well, I get it. Hey, I mentioned a little bit about our buddy. If you want to say a bit about it. Alex Jacobson.
Alex Jacobson. So there's a lineage of folks that we've got a common friend, Marty Kearney. And I'm going to name a few of them here. I was very, very fortunate to be one of the instructors at the Options Institute at SIBO. And the first was a gentleman named Alex Jacobson, who I overlapped with a little bit. He was at a competing exchange when I was with SIBO, but he really did set the standard for options education and kind of set up how exchanges do education to this day. And he passed away last Friday. But even though he was in competing exchange, whenever I asked for help or wherever I asked for advice, et cetera, he was always extremely open with that. I've never heard a person say a bad word about him, and that's pretty darn rare in our industry.
Without a doubt.
People even say bad things about you, Chief, but I never repeat them because I know that they would hurt your feelings. But my favorite Alex Jacobson story, and I've kind of copied this one. He got custom license plates that said Dr. or Dr. OEX.
Really?
yeah. That was my actual custom plate says Vex. I just can't do Dr. Vex. But my understanding is when he left, this is the fun story. When he left SIBO, and I believe he went to ISE, which is now part of the NASDAQ, with all the consolidation. When he left and went to a competing exchange, the upper management at SIBO wanted to figure out how they could take those plates away from him.
It wouldn't surprise me, the management. The management
I can see the grumpy old men on 7 going, "Oh, we get those plates away from him," because it was a pretty heated. ISE was the exchange that brought us electronic trading in the option market. And drug SIBO kicking and screaming into it. And I think that's why there was a little animosity toward Alex going to the other exchange. But I mean, what an absolute wonderful human being, and our business needs more of those. Still needs more of those.
This was back at a time where we would we were involved in a lot of seminars. I mean, I did a lot of stuff when I was chairman.
No, and I assume that you had traveled with him, et cetera, when we texted about this, I guess, yesterday or earlier.
Yeah. We never really traveled because he was always going from different places, but whenever we'd go to a money show or something, I'd go and I'd meet him there. And the funny part, Alex always wanted to go to dinner, and but he was one of these guys that wanted to go to dinner like at 5 o'clock when we were young. And I'm like, Alex, nobody goes to dinner. he wanted to be back in his room by like 6. And I'm going, Alex, the rest of the world's not even going out late. What are you doing? But anyway, but he was always fun to be with. If you had dinner with just him, there was never a lull in the conversation.
You know, going to dinner at 5 o'clock, you're not, I mean, it's interesting, fun dinner, and you're not boozing. You know, it's actual, genuine. I know exactly what you mean as far as that goes. So,
but he was so straight. I think Dr. J might have dragged him unknowingly to a strip joint one night.
Oh.
He was appalled.
Wow! Don't
want to
do that.
But Alex was. When I say the day was different, when people had seminars, there was a group that ran seminars in and out of Chicago all the time, and they did them around the country. But what PTI did was you can never advertise a seminar if you're registered. You can't say that people are going to make money trading. You can't do any of that stuff. So what we would do is we would arranged to have the mock trading where people came to the seminar, actually got to go to the trading floor and act like you were trading, and people yelling out prices and stock moving. It was really a lot of fun. And we would give, mostly my brother Dan would give maybe a 2-hour or a couple of hour lectures on how to choose your broker, how orders were put in, what's the difference between a stop loss and this and that. It was all just informative stuff that was approved by the CBOE. And we would do this, and we met so many terrific people. But Alex always took like a day or two, even though the people run the seminar, when I first started, the Options Institute was formed, I think, by the CBOE. Then they were forced to like co-manage it with the other options exchanges, and I was never aware of exactly what happened with the ICE and the split up type of thing. I don't really want to go into detail, but someday you can tell me what happened there.
Well, we ended up having two different education divisions that people would see publicly. And when I say we, I mean it's the overall industry. And the OIC kind of broke off and became a general one for the whole industry. And for instance, if I was an instructor for the Chicago Board Options Exchange, SIBO was a member of the Options Clearing Corp, and that meant that we would contribute a certain amount of material and instruction hours to the OIC. So as a SIBO instructor, I was also an OIC instructor.
Okay.
But when I went out and did, and Marty would do a really good job at explaining it, and he'd say, so for the next 3 hours, I'm taking off my SIBO hat and putting on my OIC hat. And that was kind of significant for me because I was associated with VIX, and I really wasn't supposed to talk about VIX if I was doing something with the OIC because it was a proprietary exchange product.
Okay.
So that's how things got. So the OIC would be very general option knowledge, and SIBO would be, SIBO would be VIX and SPX and all of those types of things.
We'll never forget.
That's how the split happened.
Never forget an exchange Alex had with a guy who became our big client, actually. And we did a seminar out in Las Vegas, and we were at the Golden Nugget, I think, downtown. And talk about weird stories. Everybody signed up in advance and everything. All of a sudden, this one guy comes in, this lady says, "Well, you're not registered." "Well, I know I'm not, but I'll pay right now." And she goes, "Well, nobody really does that. You're not going to let me in." And the guy's an exterminator, and he's wearing his jacket.
Uh-huh.
And the jacket said something like, "I'm the something something, so bug out." she goes, "Well, it's like $400." And the guy goes, "Okay." Pulls out $400, tosses it to her, where they took a seat. And so Alex is speaking away, and Alex, his style was he always got people engaged by asking questions before he actually got to the topic. So he wasn't like an accounting professor. He would say, "Why are you all here?" and talk to a few people. So he would do that preamble, which, by the way, I learned from. It makes it much more comfortable when you're speaking to do that. to get people engaged and ask a question, get you involved with the audience instead of just being, you know, reading from the piece of paper. So Alex says, how many people here bought stock on October, what was it, October, when was the crash, 29th?
In 87?
Yeah,
was it 19th?
19th, yeah. He goes, how many people bought stock on the 20th? This one guy raises his hand. He goes, I did. And Alex goes, no, you didn't. The guy goes, yeah, I did. No, you didn't. Nobody did. I did. So Alex goes, okay, tell me your story. And the guy, you know, this guy was a character, but he was a huge land investor and blah, blah, blah. He had been a broker like in the early 50s in Indiana or something. He was a POW of World War II. He was a character. We became really good friends, but he says, no, I didn't have anything in the market. I thought the market was way too high. I was waiting for a crash, and the thing crashed. And he goes, the day after the crash, when allegedly Blair Hull saved the world with money he didn't have, he goes, I showed up at my broker's office so early, nobody was there. I had eight things of coffee and two dozen donuts, and I woke up, and I'm sitting on their porch. Because I walked in, and I bought how many different stocks I bought in the morning. And by the time I left at 1 o'clock, I had made at least $9 in every one of the stocks.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. He goes, and he says to me, Tom, if you lay in the weeds and you make one or two trades every 2 years, only an orangutan makes a bad one. Because you're going to wait for the one time when everything is just either crazy high or crazy low. Because if you start to trade every, but this guy had I think I've told you about him before, Russell, because I never really got the mechanism, but he's a pretty bright guy, mathematics-wise. He had four different technical studies.
This is the timing thing.
Yeah, and the dude had, it was Joe Granville's, by the way, we found the book up here in the office when I was cleaning up, the Joe Granville's original, it's all math. You take a look at it next time you're here. But it was Joe Granville, there was, the candlestick, and there's like four different technical stuff.
Well, the Steve Neeson.
Yeah, he ended up finding a machine. It must have been FutureSource, where he had, back when this stuff cost a lot of money, he had four screens. And whenever all four agreed on something, he would buy or sell, mostly on the commodity side. And then he decided all he was doing, he was always right, not always, most of the time he's right, but he's always getting stopped out. He's always a little early. So he started to chart how long he was early in all the different stuff. You know, cattle, corn, pork bellies, bonds, you name it. He said every one of them, because he was doing regression analysis, which I'm sure I forgot how to do, and all of them, and he goes, every one of them had a different timing. He goes, if you wanted to go along the bellies, you waited like a week. If you wanted to go along corn, if it showed you to go along corn, you waited like 10 days. He said every one of them had a different time horizon.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, once I started doing that, all I did was, I'm making money on every trade. I'd get a buy signal in the corn, but I'd wait 8 days, and then I'd buy them. They always went down further after you got the signal, hence I'm always getting stopped out. Then they'd hit a bottom and come and start going up. I don't think it worked for, like, the spoos and stuff, though. I don't know if there's a delay there, but it was pretty fascinating. And the guy did really well. And then he got a hair up his behind about not wanting to be in the country because of estate taxes, and ended up renouncing his citizenship, and it was a big mess. But long stories there. But he was worried about estate taxes. I don't think we have to worry too much about that, Russell. But I guess they could be a big problem if you have stuff. When I say stuff, his wife,
like, big assets. Yeah, I've heard of people having to sell off a few things to cover the taxes if they haven't planned properly.
Well, his wife had befriended, when they moved to Arizona, this Indian Native American artist when he was very young. And she'd give the guy dough and feed him and stuff. And she ended up with, like, you know, maybe 100 of his sculptures or his paintings that she would buy when nobody else wanted. All of a sudden, the dude catches fire. Now he's very popular. And this guy, his name was C.W., was convinced the IRS was going to show up and say every one of those things is worth $250,000. And evidently, they don't give a rat's ass. As if you go to auction and you sell it for $50, they still want their chunk of the $250. It's not what you sell it for. It's what they appraise it at.
Yes.
So he was, did you ever hear the craziest story on that? Then we'll talk about the market. Some guy had a stuffed peregrine falcon. Now, they were an endangered species, but it was stuffed by some guy you couldn't get me to do taxidermy, but for those that don't know, taxidermy is the art of stuffing animals. Teddy Roosevelt was big at that. He'd go out and shoot stuff, and they'd stuff it. I mean, I wouldn't want to look at something I shot all day. Anyway, so because it was from this famous taxidermist, they appraised the thing at like $80,000, and yet the guy couldn't sell it because it was endangered. They wanted their piece of the 80, even though the guy couldn't sell it. This is our IRS.
Is it? Well, appraised value should be what you expect you can sell it for. So if you can't sell something, it should be appraised at zero, no, right?
No, you're talking like a citizen, not like an IRS.
No, I'm talking like somebody with two brain cells.
Like I said, you're talking about... Yeah. Well, I mean, even if those paintings that he was worried about actually were $250 a piece, they want like the check the next day. And if you decide to sell them and get $200, they don't care. I'm not saying they're worth zero, but...
Yeah. No, I get it. I just... just appraising something that can't be sold, I just...
Like I said, that was the new low. I don't. You can't get any lower than that. So what's going on with the market, the tariffs? What's going on with school? What are you teaching people?
I think we're very much in wait and see as far as the tariffs continue to go. And it's interesting. I felt like... earnings season, we might get a little bit of insight as to what companies are thinking, and companies are thinking what everybody else is thinking, which is we're just going to suspend our guidance for a little while and see how this thing plays out. So that really is where we are, and you can see it in one of the things that I really do like to look at with respect to getting a handle on what the market's thinking is what are the VIX futures doing a little bit farther out, you know, like 2, 3, 4, 5 months out, and they're all just flat in line with each other, which really does indicate a whole lot of uncertainty within the market. And I know that doesn't help anybody. But the other part of it is we usually see excess volatility follow when we see that sort of structure in the VIX market. So if anything... market related, it's just going to be a whole lot more excess volatility. I don't think that's behind us yet, and I think it's going to be volatility in both directions, not just downside volatility.
What do you make of some of the numbers that are coming out? We were talking on Monday with Greg knew the name of the guy. He actually might try and get him on the show. He's a maritime expert. He was maritime sailor and was in the Marines and all kind of anyway, but he charts all these ship flows, and evidently were people trying to get ahead of the tariffs. We've actually, and this is why the administration blamed the GNP number being low, that we imported, people were trying to get ahead of them, but we imported a whole bunch of stuff in the first quarter, and imports go against GDP, correct? So
yeah that would make sense.
So but this guy's point was that last week anyway, that the ports in Long Beach and stuff have been very, very busy because the tariffs kind of just came in. Yet if you look at ships leaving the Far East and ships on the water, it's down significantly. So
yeah, did he anything about ships turning around? Because apparently that's been a thing too.
Well, I've not heard that. But even if you know, you get 10 a day last week and it looks like everything's swimmingly, and next week you get 6 a day, how quickly does this get into the numbers? How quickly does it cause a problem, if any? As a University of Chicago guy, I'm a follower of Milton Friedman to the extent that he said inflation is the cruelest tax there is. So when you've got a population, I think, where a lot of people are gagging on inflation, the last thing you need is to increase the inflation by tariffs, even if it's less than I think it's going to be. I mean, the fact is, you can't get blood out of a rock, as they say. What's this going to do, Russell? I mean, is it?
That's the thing is, I don't know if it's going to be an inflationary I really don't know if it's going to cause the kind of inflation that people are worried about, especially within our day-to-day essentials. You know, we are energy self-sufficient and we are food self-sufficient. And if tariffs are, if other countries are going to start imposing tariffs on our food products, well, then that might mean that we have more of them here, and the supply demand actually, we might not hear people griping about the price of eggs anymore, and we might not hear people griping about the cost of gas at the pump. Whatever the hot toys are around Christmas might be excessively expensive, but I think that the need to haves, which we're mostly self-sufficient with, I just don't see them being impacted by the tariffs.
You better hope that the daughter doesn't bang one of the taillights in your car, because like 50%
of do you have like spy cams on my house?
No, but I know that I had to get a couple taillights. I didn't bang on my Suburban, but they just conked out.
I think somebody was texting when they were pulling into the garage. That's what I think happened.
Now that's an accusation. I have attorneys that'll defend her.
I got cameras all over this house, man. If I really wanted to see video of the act of what happened, I just did that. And it wasn't terrible, but I'll bet you in 6 months if I do that, it might be a bigger issue.
Well, it's funny because I just had this long discussion with Professor Hal yesterday. Mm-hmm. And he, like you, by the way, I agree with Debodius, as they say in the South Side. We're not really going to know in terms of how the curves all move and everything like that, and who eats what. But my point is, and I'll make it to the big economist in the sky if I have to. By the administration's estimates, and I think they're way high in the estimates, so again, I'm agreeing with you on that part. Last year, the tariff revenue in this country was $67 billion. We've always had tariffs, right?
Mm-hmm.
The estimate this year is $660 billion. So a $600 billion tax increase. Now, I happen to think that they're crazy with that number. It's probably more like 350 or 4. But even if it is, somebody is ponying up $400 billion in taxes that they didn't pay before. It's coming out of somebody's hide. And the idea that somehow or another it'll all like shake out and they'll have a couple of discussions with people and blah, blah, blah. Does anybody think that the number is going to end up less than it was before or even what it was before? I don't see
I don't think it'll end up less than what it was before. But, again, I want to see how the whole thing plays out. Unfortunately, we just don't have an idea as to what we have very, very little idea as to what all of this is going to look like when they're done doing all of the negotiating.
This is the argument I'm saying.
And it's very possible that countries that have been charging higher, have been charging tariffs to us on goods that we send them, that stuff may come down a bit, and everything balances itself out a little bit better than most people think it's going to.
This is so weird. I don't know why I'm so different in my view on this. I mean, I agree with you. Nobody knows exactly where it's going to land, but the idea that somehow we're going to be back to even, we're talking, this has to be what, twice the biggest tax increase ever in this country? How do you just blow it off and say we don't know where it's going to land? It's going to land somewhere. It's going to be in our pocket.
But we don't even know if that tariff number is going to go, if the the cost of goods is going to go up that much.
So,
let's say in 2024, that $100 billion was collected in tariffs. Just really to use a round number,
it was 67
because it's just easier to follow along with.
Actually, it was 67.
Do what?
Actually, it was 67.
I know that, but yeah. I'm trying to use round numbers
fair enough.
For an illustration here.
All right.
So let's just say it was 100. And everybody's saying that that number is going to go up to 500 in 2025. Well, that's based on, you know, current numbers that are being thrown out there, not the ultimate negotiated number. And the ultimate negotiated number is probably going to be lower, but, you know, do we get some other types of benefits through selling more stuff internationally than we have been? You know, are there other offsets that are going to come in here that are going to work in there that don't make it, you know, the ultimate tax increase that not everybody but a lot of people refer to it as?
I'm absolutely with you. I don't want to beat this up for 2 days.
And does that mean that, you know, there's certain things that you know, we buy from overseas that are now going to be a bit more competitively priced and built in the U.S. And maybe the price is a little bit higher, but it also generates more tax revenue from more people building whatever that is in the United States.
I'm agreeing with...
That's the part where... The part where this massive manufacturing coming back to the United States... If you're going to do that, you've got to have smart immigration as well, so you have people to man those factories.
That's where
there's a real issue, and that, immigration and tariff policy should be they should be the same thing.
You know, this estimated tax increase
mm-hmm.
is bigger than the entire corporate tax revenue in this country.
Mm-hmm.
Why? I guess I don't. Wait, and there's nobody smarter than the people I have on this show. Why am I having so much trouble even getting some acknowledgement of the enormity of this and how maybe 3 years from now...
Because it hasn't been officially implemented.
I think it was implemented last week.
Isn't there like a 90-day...
A few places, depending on who they like and don't like. But, I mean, the fact is, I don't know where you can find tariffs paid to date, but it's... I'm saying even if it's half of what they say, let's put it this way. If it's two-thirds of what they say, it's almost as much as the entire corporate tax revenue.
Okay.
I mean, I started by saying I don't agree with their estimate. I think they're too high. But
oh, yeah. No, I think they're ridiculous.
But even if it's $400 billion, my God, that's a number.
Yeah. What's that come to, $1,200 a person?
$400 billion? Maybe, but
there's 300 million of us.
All right, so that's 4,800 for your family. That's a number.
Okay. Yeah, it's 1,200 for each of us.
That's a number.
I know. I can put those girls to work. They need 1,200.
Yeah. You got the best group. What about the dogs? What about their dog food? Well, I guess they're paying more on that.
Gosh. Luckily, we're downsizing dogs a week from today. So,
you still got the two, right?
The current temp one has been adopted out a week from today.
Are you gonna miss him or her?
I don't know, man. This one's freaking crazy.
Oh God! What do you say we do?
You come downstairs and the dog is like just standing on the dining room table, looking at you.
God.
Like, how the hell did you get up there? What did you think you were gonna accomplish?
Now
you can't get down. Should I leave you up? You know, this one.
God. Audrey's poodle, I don't know what the story is. We got to go break here, but yeah. I don't know what the hang up with her is. She goes through all my pockets.
I used to have a dog that would do that.
Nobody else's, just mine.
No, I would do that, and I'd actually crawl through the sleeve. Like if I left my jacket on the couch, would go through the pockets and then crawl through each of the sleeves to make sure there wasn't anything in there as well.
What if he got buried in there, dog?
I have no idea.
SP Futures up 17, NASA Futures up 40. Be right back, Stacks and Jacks.
Hello, this is Tom Howe, the Chief. I think most of you know that I'm also the Chief Investment Officer at PTI Securities and Futures. There we invest for and help a wide variety of clients. And you know what? No two are the same. Some have legacy stocks, some concentration issues, some maybe embedded tax issues. The others might need or want some portfolio protection. There could be estate issues or maybe new family members. The point is that we are all unique and the portfolios should match. However, the last several years have seen a relatively one-way market. It seemed that all we needed was to be all in. No protection, no fixed income, just be all in, no matter who you are, what your risk profile or age. Most management firms love that. Take this and like it, no matter who you are. Be careful with that. You are not everybody. I think most see the market view going forward as maybe different than the one looking back, so your portfolio should reflect that. Maybe it's just as simple as your life station has changed. Towards that end, we are accepting some new clients needing a more personal approach and are interested in negotiating the future and not with a portfolio designed for the past. Find me at 312-663-4310. That's 312-663-4310.
Stocks, jocks,
stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here.
Hello, and welcome back, Stocks and Jacks. I'm Tom Andrew on the board. SP Futures up 20, NASDAQ Futures up 50. We're up a whole boatload more than this, especially last night. I think the NASDAQ might have went up like 180 or something, but we're still up. We've had two down days in a row, and so we're bouncing back from that. So maybe it'll be a good day for the bulls today. I have individual stocks. I've got Disney up 733 after their earnings came out. A lot of people were, you know, pretty worried about their earnings, but obviously they did pretty well. Honeywell's up $4. Those are individual stocks. Now Caterpillar up $1.91, a $1.51. Sorry. So not not really crazy this morning. Not like it has been. Over in Europe, we've got the DAX down 19. Call that flat. They've been up the last few days. FTSE down 38.4%. CAC around down 41.5. So moderately down there. And I have to make sure I had Russell. I have to ask him why all these things are close. But the Nikkei is open today, down 51.1. Hang Seng up 29.1. Shanghai up 26. They were close for like 5 days. And I don't, it's not the new year. I don't know what it was over there. But the, maybe Russell will tell us. 10-year 4.32, kind of unchanged. The Bund down 2 basis points, 2.50. Oil, which has been getting clobbered, but it's back up to 59.49. Boy, I sure wish I was on the buy at 55.50 Monday morning. Wow. It's a long way away from here. Brent up 34 cents, 62.49. Natural gas up 13 cents, 3.59. Arbob unchanged, 205. Gold, which has been on a huge tear, is giving a little bit of that back today, down $29. They're up like $80 2 days in a row. We're at 33.92, so we were over 3,400. We've backed off that. Silver down 34 cents. They were up like a dollar yesterday, 33.01 on the silver. Foreign exchange, we've got the euro at 1.14, which is kind of where it was the last few days. British pound at 1.33, sort of the dollar is rising against the yen. I guess that's part of the trade talks. We don't know what's going to happen there, but maybe something good. Bitcoin up 1,800, 96,895. What do you have for us, Traffic Weather Sports?
All right, it is 7:39 here in Chicago. On May 7th. Just a little bit of sports here. As we mentioned earlier, the Cubs lost to the Giants, tying with 5 points all the way to the 11th inning. And the Giants then scored 9, bringing them the win 14-5. Over to Chicago weather. It is currently 60 degrees. Going to be sunny and a little cooler throughout the day. We're going to have a high of 64 and some light breezes throughout the afternoon. Over in Phoenix, they're currently at 63 degrees. They're going to have a sunny day, but a little bit of thunderstorms throughout some spots in the afternoon, and they're going to have a high of 85. Finally, for Chicago traffic, things are building on every major expressway on the inbound side. If you're on the outbound, things are building on the Kennedy and the Edens, but thankfully no accidents to report. So that's all I got. Back to you, Chief.
Russell, I want to ask you about China. What were they closed for like a week? You ready?
This is usually the new year.
The new year was like a couple of months ago.
I'm trying to find it. I don't know.
Hey,
I
mean, by the way, when are you going to this?
I didn't realize they were closed that long.
Are you heading out to the Trump Golf Club on May 22nd? Well, if you don't know, you're probably not going. You're not invested in dollar Trump crypto?
No, gosh, no.
We'll get a little.
They're having a conference for their crypto people.
And I'm just going to read this. I'm not going to give any opinion. This is Trump's new meme coin, whatever that even is. 58 wallets have made over $10 million each from President Donald Trump's meme coin, totaling $1.1 billion in profits. Blockchain analytics and chain analysis, whatever they are, said. Now, this is a article written by Mackenzie Sigalos on CNBC, so I'll give her points. a little of this. 764,000 wallets of mostly small holders have lost money, according to the firm. So now the Dollar Trump event sent for May 22nd at Trump National Golf Club in Washington, D.C. I didn't know we had a golf club there, too. Includes a reception for the 25 wallets with the largest balance, along with a White House tour. I just put it out there. Anybody can make their own conclusions, but I'm sitting there going,
just, why does he do crap like that?
I don't know, but obviously.
And why does he do, I watch, and I try to watch him unfiltered. And he was on. He was interviewed one-on-one on one of the. He was on NBC, and I forgot who was interviewing him on Sunday morning. And you know, they asked him a question about. I can't even remember what the question was about. And half of his answer is about MSNBC being a failing network that this person's parent wants to sell off. You know, if the man would have a 1%. Of Reagan's communication ability, we would be in a completely different world. And people, you know, you wouldn't have people vandalizing Teslas, et cetera, because they just can't stand the guy.
Yeah.
And I know this Elon they can't stand, but it's through his association with Trump. Yeah. And it's my biggest frustration with the guy, because I do agree that we need to be doing it. Like, I agree we need to be doing stuff with China. I've had no secret about it when I talk to you. They played unfairly with us for a very long time. They do not have our best interests at heart. They're expansionists. They want to basically dominate all of their neighbors. We said we wanted to rename Gulf of Mexico the Gulf of America. You know, if China's version of that is they would claim the whole Gulf.
Yeah, well, yeah.
That's what because they claim the whole South China Sea. You know, I wish he would just, if he would stick to topic, he would explain why without being a jerk about it. I think he'd have a lot more people on board. I don't think he cares if he has people on board or not. He doesn't have to get elected again, but. You know, it would help the cause an awful lot. And I always felt like his oldest daughter was the one that reined him in a bit. And she's not working in this White House. So, you know, maybe.
Let me ask you a very, very serious question. Going back, uh-huh. And everybody, I don't know if you've been listening to the shows, but we've been bandying this about now for a couple of weeks. I am incredibly opposed to the tariff shotgun to solve some of these problems that have popped up.
I am too.
Okay,
I am too.
All right, but let me. Okay, so, but I think honestly, it because of the people involved, meaning him, this is an excuse to tax the living shit out of the middle class yet again. And I honestly believe that because that's what's happening. But let's set it aside. Let's say the entire free trade thought of the Milton Friedmans of the world, which I think at the time made an awful lot of sense, has been, I'll use the term, co-opted, corrupted, whatever you want to use, by some countries, maybe China the worst perpetrator, but maybe not the only, that have decided to compete in ways that we wouldn't allow here. Child labor, slave labor, pollution. And by the way, our firms dove into it head over fist because they got stuff cheaper. They didn't care. Now, I think you and I and virtually every listener on this show doesn't like to see that happen. We don't like to see slave labor someplace. We don't like to see 14-year-olds. Now, the tariff is one way of going about it. I think it's a horse bleep way. But I also know that something has to happen. Now, what is it? Is it we will not do business, and we're going to come right out in the Oval Office and say we're not going to do business with anybody who lets people work under the age of 16. And oh, by the way, we're sure as hell not going to do business with anybody who has slave labor, and you know we're not going to do business with anybody who belches air in the polluted air in the sky, because guess what? Someday we're going to be breathing it. Now, that would be tough because our big firms here, which give the guy all the money, or would give me all the money if I was president, probably too. They're not. They're against that. What are you talking about? We're over there. Look at the investment we have there. I think there has to be some sort of a solution here, Russell. I don't know what it is, but I don't think tariffs is it. because at the end of the day, if all the other crap is solved with China and they let us sell some stuff over there or whatever the deal is, if they still have 12-year-olds working making the stuff for Apple and people or whoever is doing over there, I still got a problem with it. The tariffs didn't solve that at all. So
and that part is definitely not being addressed or solved or anything else. And in reality, it would be nice if, you know, I don't think there's a, you know, I don't think there's a realization as to how our thing. I think there's a people understand that the people that are assembling our iPhones in China, and now more so in India than China, that continues to be a trend. But the people that are doing that, I think the people here, yes, they don't have quite the nice, but most people probably don't even think it through. But if you start to think it through, they don't have quite the same, you know, lifestyle as we do, standard of living, et cetera. But I don't think people realize that that they're basically slave labor. You know, the places that they would assemble iPhones, they had to put nets outside of the factory to catch people that tried to kill themselves. Yeah, at a Foxconn factory. You know, that's I don't care if the people are being paid or not. Anybody that can't stand their job that much is basically slave labor, in my mind.
Yeah.
And the shotgun approach thing, that's where I'm very frustrated. You can make a you would think this is more of a Democrat than a Republican thing, but you can make a strong liberal type argument that we shouldn't be buying crap from China because of the way they treat their people. You know, if you think conservatives treat people badly, you should be a fly on the wall with the way the Communist Party treats their population.
You're saying they're liberal?
No. I'm saying liberals in the U.S. If they champion the little guy, etc., they should never buy a single thing from China.
I'm with you.
You know what I mean? I mean, none of us should. But you know, if you think Republicans or conservatives in the U.S. are the bad guys and they treat the little guy badly, go spend a week in China and see how they treat their workers.
Well, I mean,
and get back to me on what's worse.
Well, if you degrade human behavior over the centuries, it's pretty hard to find a bottom.
Ever since
I've been on the air, Russell, when John and I were on the score, I would say, I can't imagine if somebody dumped anybody I know in the Oval Office, how would you deal with it? Boy, it's going back ages. When mm-hmm. you know, Bill Gates says, hey, look, these bleeps got 90 million computers and they bought one thing of software. Obviously, they're pirating the software. And then, you sit there and he leaves the Oval Office. The next guy comes in, it's a chairman of Coke. What are you talking about? There's a billion and a half people of yellow complexion drinking a Coke a day. It's the greatest thing that ever happened. I mean, it is so inconsistent in terms of people that are selling stuff there.
I think one of the things that has happened, and this actually comes from, SIBO tried really hard to get one of the exchanges in China to license VIX, and it just never happened. But,
this is not it's not Hong Kong, a mainland place.
Yeah. That was the ultimate end goal of sending me over to mainland China and having me talk to all the different exchanges and hosting all the different exchange people in our exchange. We did it for 3 or 4 years, and all the while negotiating on launching a China VIX. But it became pretty obvious to me that they were trying to figure out how to create their own volatility index how to copy all of our stuff. And we were starting to take their phones away and stuff when we took them to different parts of the exchange because all they did was take pictures of everything.
You remember Chris Manns used to be on the show. He had a group here for the agricultural group, and we went for the a tour of a ethanol plant. Boy, if you ever want to see an interesting tour, boy, those places, they are really something.
I've done that.
They're pretty cool, aren't they?
I've covered the chemical industry and had to do that. But I don't want to get off topic.
What I'm saying, he said no phones, and they were all pissed off.
Well, here's the thing with the China thing and the Coke versus the the one benefiting from the cheap labor, or you know, the ones being ripped off versus nobody's made money in China. No U.S. companies have made money in China.
You said, is it because they have to own 51% or what?
It's because you've got to work with partnerships with them. They make repatriating earnings damn near impossible. There's a former Options Institute instructor that did some classes that he got paid for over in China, and he got paid, and he had to open up a Chinese bank account, and they paid him in the Chinese bank account. He's never allowed to take that money out except to cover the expenses.
Who's the winner?
Like 2 or 3 years.
Who's the winner? The party guys you got to pay off?
Well, you got to pay those guys.
That's what I'm saying. Are they the big? They the big winners?
Yeah, I guess they would be.
Because the companies here aren't doing so hot. The workers aren't doing so hot. Yet there's money going somewhere. Where's the somewhere?
Well, I don't think there's a whole. I mean, I think the money that goes in there. I don't think it. It's almost like a Ponzi scheme type thing. Money goes in, they can make more cheap crap. They sell us cheap crap. More money goes in, they make more. Now all of a sudden the cash flow is being cut off. How long can they survive after that?
All right, well, we got 7-8 minutes here. Explain how to everybody, including me. Let's pick blue jeans, for instance. Now, the cotton is generally grown here, correct?
No.
I thought a lot of the cotton. We exported cotton over there.
All the cotton comes from China now.
Wasn't there a time when
cotton, specifically the majority of cotton in the world comes from where the Uyghurs are basically slave labor, and the Uyghurs are Muslims. Cotton doesn't come from here.
Well, didn't it at one point? A lot of it. Right, so when it came from here, the cotton gets in a container, cotton goes over there, somebody buys a container of our cotton, throws it in a factory, everybody spits out the other end blue jeans, and here nobody wants the dyes or the other stuff because evidently it's a dirty process, and the blue jeans get back in another container, and they come back over here. Who's getting paid what where? I mean, I'm curious.
Well, I mean, we sell the raw materials, we get paid, but I'm not really sure how much we send to them in raw material. I think they get it because it's cheaper from other areas.
Well, so that's our exports to them. Wasn't there a time when virtually all their cotton came from us, or was that 20 years ago?
Now they basically have the ability to do that themselves. But I've got a list of dollar wise what we send over there.
All right, so Levi's,
as far as raw materials going, I'm trying to.
All right, it comes back as Levi's or Wrangler. Levi's or Wrangler have over there?
We hardly sell anything to them.
Okay, but now it's going to come back.
We sell less than $2 billion in motor vehicle parts.
Okay.
In non-ferrous metals, it's less than $2 billion. I'm looking at it like we send $1 billion worth of coal to them a year. Cotton is not even on here.
All right, so how does Levi's end up with the blue jeans? Do they have to have a company over there, Levi's China, that's 51% owned by the party, or
a different firm. You contract like Apple, an Apple iPhone. This is an easier one for me because I know how that works. Apple doesn't have a factory over there; they contract out to a firm called Foxconn, and that's who does it for them. You contract out and it's really not manufacturing; it's more of assembly. I was having this discussion with a cousin from Germany that was in Chicago last week, and they were like, yeah, but all of your electronics come from China. I said, yeah, but they're assembled in China. I said, all the really technical stuff is done elsewhere and then, you know, grouped together in China and assembled in China.
Well, I read that Apple's only got, I think this number's right, there's 14,000 Apple employees there, but the support group, mostly Foxconn's, 1.5 million people.
Yeah. Yeah,
and who owns Foxconn?
And really, they've done it quietly. And this did come up on their last call. I believe they said on the last call that more iPhones are being assembled in India than China now.
But So does that mean...
And that's who we should be working with. They're the world's biggest democracy versus communism.
But is I guess my next question is, being an assembler sort of dude, are the 1.5 million people in China now sending all the screens and all the other crap to India and then just putting it together there?
They weren't making the screen part. The Gorilla Glass, those higher end technical stuff's being done elsewhere and then sent to them for assembly.
Well, I guess, all right, the next question is, what are the 1.5 million support people from Foxconn? What do they do for Apple? Everything?
They do the exact same rote motion from day to day.
Okay.
It's like an assembly line worker. I watched a video of it the other day. It was almost comical because it's like they were sitting in lounge chairs and just turning a screw over and over again.
Well, I mean, the article I was reading said something about it's not that easy to switch because this 1.5 million person supply chain is a 20-year phenomenon. It's not a 2-year phenomenon.
They've been doing it for a while. This isn't something they came up with. Apple's been doing this for about 2 or 3 years. Okay. They've been doing it they've been doing it since COVID.
Oh, so they've been getting people sneaking out. Okay.
Started doing it. But you don't, because the Chinese are like dealing with a 4-year-old child when you tell them no. If you say we're going to move all of our manufacturing to India, China's going to punish the crap out of you immediately.
Yep.
If you just do it and don't say anything about it, and by the time everybody wakes up and sees what you've done, it's kind of too late. You avoid any backlash from China, but they. Apple's already been getting backlash from China. Government employees are not allowed to use the Apple phones anymore. There's already been all kinds of pushback there, and that was long before the tariffs.
So you're saying this 1.5 million people might actually be down to 1.2 million, and there's 300,000 in India.
I assume it would take the same number of people in India that it does in China.
It's complex, and
it's something that I think a lot of very smart companies have been diversifying their exposure to China, and China has even been diversifying their exposure to China by moving manufacturing to Vietnam. You know, the exact same companies that were doing something in China because they're worried about the tariffs and the whole idea that some people try to avoid buying Chinese goods in the U.S. but are okay buying Vietnamese even though they're the exact same company. It's funny because those companies moved things to Vietnam, and then all of a sudden we stepped up, and that's why we said we were going to do the tariff on Vietnam, because it's really a roundabout tariff on China, where China had tried to get ahead and get around this stuff.
If you're going to pick 5 places in a row where you'd go from China, is it Vietnam, South Korea, India? What about the Philippines? Where else would you go? Is there other places?
Well, I would go to Mexico.
Okay.
You gotta. And this loops back to, I just so, and I know we're up against time, but I'm just so crazy about this idea. You know, why don't you have manufacturing and assembly firms that hire people just on the other side of the border in Mexico and then bring them up here and, you know, make our iPhones here?
I thought we did. What's the name of it?
American Dream, instead of having them run across by a drug mule and fending for themselves.
What is the zone on just the other side of the Rio Grande? Is there some kind of enterprise zone there? What's that called?
I know what you're talking about, and it's kind of like a NAFTA remnant, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, Bernie Sanders was saying it was.
I don't understand why we don't have our stuff assembled in our hemisphere as opposed to, you know, over in China.
Well, wherever the money seems to lead, it leads. It's unfortunate, but so are you here? Or are you?
I think working closely with Mexico and Canada, and that's the shotgun approach that included them. That I think that part's a huge mistake in how this is being handled.
Yeah, I don't.
And something needs to be done. It's just they're probably was a bit more subtle way to go about doing things. But our current president is not the most subtle guy ever.
When are we going to? Since the big hole in the budget, we got to go here. But next week, maybe. Since the massive hole in the budget continues to be healthcare, when are we going to talk about that? Ever?
It is the one. He even talked about low-income housing and hasn't touched health care yet. Notice I say yet.
Yeah, I don't.
Yeah, at some point, that one's got to get covered as well.
Well, are you here or are you Indy?
I'm here. I'm in the backyard.
All right, bud.
Looking at a short-term dog.
Oh, God. It'll be long-term for somebody else.
Yeah, she's moving only one suburb over. I have a funny feeling we'll see her again.
God.
Come over for a play date. Come over to stand on the table and tell us who's boss.
They are interesting.
They are.
Remember my goofy dog Scruff. He couldn't get up the front steps without you holding his back legs. His back legs were pretty much shot when I got him. But as long as you grabbed his back legs, he'd walk up with his front legs, and he thought he did it himself, right? He wasn't the brightest bulb.
Very proud of himself.
So one night, I didn't have time to take the garbage out, so I put the garbage on top of the counter. I'm thinking, no way that knucklehead gets up there. I get home, and sure enough, he got in. How the hell he got up there, I have no idea. He must have went and got a ladder. I mean, I'm like, how the hell you can't get on the sofa. How the hell did you get on the counter? I'm like, sometimes they amaze you. S&P futures up 15, NASDAQ futures up 43. Talk to you next week, but if not sooner, back tomorrow, Stocks and Jacks.
That's all, folks.